5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to The New Next, the podcast where tomorrow is today and the future is now. I'm your host, Matthew Jensen, and together we'll embark on a journey through the evolving landscapes of technology, innovation, and the current events shaping our world. Join us as we engage with thought leaders, innovators, and disruptors, breaking down complex topics into actionable insights. Whether you're a tech enthusiast, a forward thinker, or just curious about the world's next chapter, you're in the right place. So plug in, power up, and prepare to deep dive into the heart of what's new, what's next, and what that all means for you. Welcome to The New Next. Let's explore the future together.
Here we have a special guest today. It's Robin Bolton. She's an innovation expert and founder of MileZero.io, and also Chief Navigator, which I love that title absolutely, because I feel that in her realm of expertise, which is, I'd say, innovation strategy consulting and coaching, you know, navigation is the key point. So I'm really excited to have this conversation today, because I feel like you, kind of like myself, take a different approach when approaching clients, which is more holistically. And, you know, that's always exciting to people, talking to people that are innovators in their own right. If you wanted to just jump off and give a little pitch on your business, tell me a little bit more about what you do and our listeners, that would be awesome.
Yeah, no, thank you, Matt. I am so excited to be here and join you in the conversation, because taking a holistic approach is, like, that's how change gets made. So I am founder and chief navigator of Mile Zero, which is a consultancy that works with leaders in medium to large businesses to help them use innovation to kind of confidently and reliably grow their business. And the way I do that, like you already mentioned so beautifully, is taking a holistic approach. So I call it the innovation ABCs. So looking at the architecture of innovation and, you know, what are the processes, the structures, the strategy, governance metrics, all of that stuff that's very businessy. So what's the architecture? Also, what are the behaviors, and specifically the leadership behaviors, that foster innovation? Because innovation requires leaders to engage very differently than how they engage in operations. And then last, the C is the culture and the capabilities. And how are they building an organization that is able to just kind of repeatedly innovate and engage in, you know, the questioning and the curiosity and the creativity that's required to continually improve or innovate. So that's the work that I do. And it is very fun and very challenging. And I guess that's probably why I love it.
So you kind of come in and almost like a football coach or something, provide a strategic playbook for them to implement a program and then develop off of. And then from what I understand, you also are involved in the executive coaching aspect. So I assume, you know, you're kind of setting them on a good path and then holding them accountable over time to really implement that for their business.
Yeah. I kind of play, say, a player coach role, you know, especially in the beginning of coming in. Usually it's at a point where an organization is, you know, they know what their growth goals are. And they've kind of looked around and they're like, well, you know, if as we keep doing what we're doing, that will only get us part of the way there. And so we have this gap and we don't know how to fill that gap. So I kind of come in that really early phase where people know they need something, but it's just so ambiguous. And like you said, kind of come in with a playbook and an approach, and, you know, or say player coach, because I'm doing some of the things, kind of role modeling, teaching, making the progress happen, as well as coaching people in how to do this and build their capabilities. Ultimately getting to a point where then, yeah, I kind of take the step back and then, you know, just a coach, my playing days are over, I'm just coaching. And eventually they're kind of off and running, having both, the line of sight, the projects, the strategy and the pathway to filling their growth gap, as well as the capabilities internally, so that, you know, should they ever find themselves in the same situation, they don't need me. So yeah. Trying to put myself out of business, basically.
Yeah, which is truly the goal of a good holistic consultant. And so you probably work on pretty much any capacity that drives innovation in the business, from finding the right people to finding the right ideas. How does that process really work on kind of a day-to-day, maybe on the collaboration aspect, like finding where the targets are and really evaluating the business as it is now?
Yeah, it's, as you said, it kind of varies, but there's always, you know, there's always some commonality, some kind of general rules of thumb. And, you know, the first thing is always like, okay, well, what do we need the innovation to deliver? You know, a lot of people shy away from putting a number on it. And let's just be honest, like, business is about numbers. And so instead of trying to ignore that fact, let's embrace it. Let's acknowledge it. Let's put a number on it and work towards that. The second thing is making sure, again, before you even start looking, you know, what is going to support the business strategy? And that's, in a lot of ways, looking at those two things are kind of where the idea for being a navigator comes from, is because, like, you don't set off on a journey and be like, I don't know, I got a backpack, and then, like, walk out the door and see what happens, which is what a lot of people do with innovation. Like, we need to be innovative. Let's go innovate. And then, like, okay, why? And it's starting off with, like, okay, where do we want to go? There's lots of different ways to get there. So what are the ways that are consistent with what we need to achieve? And, you know, it's not a straight line. It's not something that can be 100% predicted. If it were, it's not innovation, but it's also not chaos, right? Yeah. You're like, okay, you know, I was working years ago with a publisher, and we were trying to say, they're like, we need to grow. Okay, great. You need to grow. Where aren't you willing to go? They're like, no, we're willing to do anything. I'm like, okay. So you're going to open a store. And they're like, yeah, why would we open a store? I'm like, okay, well, that's something that you are not going to do. And that is great, because now it means that we won't focus on that. When we go out and look at what the opportunities are, if opening a store emerges as a possibility, we can say, no, we're not going to do that, and focus on things that are more likely to happen.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and from the outside, you see a lot of corporate innovation programs that seem to just go in circles. And, you know, it's not as easy as just going out and throwing money at the problem and just hiring some random people and say, go innovate. Or I've seen too, is that you have, I've seen some pretty rough experiences where innovation has gone around this one sort of idea, and everything's gone into it, but then they never really asked if whether or not there was a market there to support it. So you have, like, big fanfare, and then it is told dead.
Yeah. Just because you can doesn't mean you should. And yeah, no, I'm definitely seeing kind of the same thing where, you know, the company's like, hey, we can do this. And so they go all in on it. And it's like, ooh. Okay, sometimes people get lucky when they do that, but you're relying a lot on work, on luck. You know, I've also seen, as I'm sure you have, the innovation events, you know, the hackathons and the shark tanks. And, you know, I have such a, I always sigh. I haven't been able to stop myself sighing when I talk about them, because in the moment, they're great. What comes after, I have seen become so destructive. And what I mean by that is, you know, everybody's super excited during the hackathon or during the Shark Tank or whatever. And like, they feel like we finally have freedom to be creative and to be innovative and to ask questions and challenge things. And like everything wonderful and innovation-y is happening.
Yeah.
And then the event comes to an end and it's like back to how things were before. And people are kind of like, But I want to keep acting that. Like, I want to keep being innovative. I want to keep asking questions. And like, you know, also we put so much work into our ideas and like nothing's coming from it. And it just kind of leads to then, you know, the engagement falls off and people start getting, you know, disillusioned. And at worst, they get cynical. And so this great event with all of these great intentions end up leading to the exact opposite.
Yeah, that's very depressing.
Of where they wanted. And it's just like, it's so heartbreaking.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's pretty true, because you're trying to just plug in. And I think that's the advantage of the holistic approach. Because when you're doing this other thing where, hey, let's just do a hackathon, that's going to solve everything, there's not typically this conversation about what's next. And how do we integrate this? How do we implement a overall innovation strategy that's shaped around, you know, the culture that you're talking about?
Yeah. It really is, again, going back to that holistic approach of like a hackathon in and of itself is not a bad thing. You know, it's a great way to build an innovation culture and build innovation capabilities. And you've got to plan for it as part of a bigger effort, and you need to focus it. Again, going back to like what will be helpful to the company, and you need to have a plan for what happens after, because people are coming in with expectations of, hey, if I win, something happens. Like, you keep working on this. If you think this is a winning idea, then you keep supporting it. And yeah, so it's not about, oh, we have an event. It's about, we have an event that is part of a bigger commitment and investment in building a capacity around innovation.
How would you see innovation differently? You know, perhaps maybe from like a tech company that's very innovative, versus perhaps like a oil and gas or energy company that's, I would say, really risk averse and returns focused. But, you know, from me, I see that many times your long-term returns do get really subdued by the risk averse nature of just trying to get those consistent returns like you know it. How do you see that kind of like differentiator and the culture and strategy, and perhaps ways that you can conquer that traditional way of thinking?
Yeah, I'm laughing because this year I've worked with clients in both of those industries, and you know, they're very different and also very similar. And what I mean by that is, you know, working with somebody very much in the tech space, like new technology, totally breakthrough. They operate and innovate and think and work and just do everything at a fundamentally different pace. So like every few days to few weeks, you know, they're kind of going off after another opportunity because they can't, because they have that kind of flexibility. But what that can lead to then is they're just totally scattered.
Yeah.
And not really making any forward progress on any one thing because they're trying to do all the things. Mm-hmm. And so you're kind of like, how about we, like, instead of doing 30 things, what if we did 5? And so it's kind of the, you know, just because you can doesn't mean you should. Let's focus. Yeah. And that doesn't mean we have to stay here forever, but like, focus. And then on the other side, you know, working in oil and gas and heavy machinery and in industrials, you know, I think I shared this story with you. You know, I was working with a client and they had one of their customers called up and said, hey, this piece of machinery we bought from you in the 1950s has stopped working. Do you have a replacement? And they literally went into the warehouse. I'm like, yeah, we have the version from 1974. We'll get it out today. So like, that is a fundamentally different time frame for innovation. And so what you see with them is that adapting to be faster, whereas like with the tech company, you're trying to almost slow them down, like focus.
Yeah.
And like, let's be more thoughtful. And then with oil and gas, you're trying to almost open the aperture. Be like, what else could you do? You know, we've worked a lot on adjacent innovation of where could we take existing products into new markets, or what new products could we create to serve your existing markets and then push them to move faster.
Yeah, definitely.
Which, again, when we're talking about things that are 50 years old, faster is not measured in days or weeks. It's at best measured in months. So they both face challenges. They're just different ends of the challenge spectrum.
Yeah, I think you make a good point on the machinery aspect, because they do have a lot of perhaps cost goods sold. And mm-hmm. often there's so much innovation potential on the market research, kind of customer segmentation portion, and finding out where your customers are and what value mm-hmm. you provide to them. Or,
yep.
or just making what's tried and true a little bit more efficient.
Yeah. Yeah. And both are super important. I mean, you need to constantly improve what you're doing because your competitors are doing that as well. And, you know, where I see a lot of companies understandably get a bit skittish is having those customer conversations to understand what their customers, how their customers see them and what their customers think of them, because you will often get answers you don't expect. And yep. sometimes they're answers you don't want to hear, but like, you know, perception is reality. And it can be really hard. Like, it can be hard to hear that, you know, with this client that I was working with in the heavy machinery, like they had been so great for so long at a very specific set of things that that's how their customers saw them. And trying to get their customers to see them as something even just a little bit more, you know, not radically different, just like, you know, in addition to this piece, we can make this piece that connects to it. So we're not talking anything crazy. And even then it was like, you could tell their customers were kind of struggling to be like, really, you can do that? Really? Is that possible? It's like,
yeah, definitely.
Yeah, we've been doing it for 30 years, just not for you. So like, believe us, we can do it.
Yeah. How often do you see, on the tech side, how often do you see
yeah.
them take products that they're developing internally for themselves and kind of tweak that into basically a commercial product?
Honestly, not as often as I should, because what those tech companies, those tech startups are doing, you know, for themselves is awesome. It's incredibly cool stuff. And the problems they're experiencing that lead to those are not unique problems.
Yeah.
And so oftentimes what they're developing for themselves, those could absolutely become revenue sources. You know, then it comes to kind of the question of identity, of like, what is the identity of the company? And, you know, if you have something like that you've developed internally and it's not a fit with the identity of the company, then then you can have a really interesting conversation of like, ooh, you know, should we shift? Do we actually have something kind of by accident that's better as a business? Should we just keep it to ourselves or should we spin it out? But even bringing that kind of lens, that questioning of like, hey, we created this to solve a problem. Other people have this problem. What should we do? Is a really important conversation to have.
Yeah. A big trend in, I'd say, the last 10 years is large corporations starting almost venture seed capital funds that work adjacent to their business. Both that deploy capital, but also kind of test the waters outside of the capital structure to see if they can, you know, solve a problem or reach a new market without having it be a distraction. I was just curious your thoughts on that, and if you have any, I guess, best practices that you see on how to do that.
Yeah, no, corporate venture capital, CVC, there's enormous potential there. And I think what led to it was a wonderful moment of honesty on the part of corporations of like, hey, we're really good at what we do, and we're not really good at disrupting that, of creating something that challenges our very reason for existence. Like, good job acknowledging that. And so that led to corporate venture capital, which is an awesome tool. And it was great to see companies invest in that, kind of take the mindset of, you know, we don't have the culture, the capabilities, et cetera, to build something radically different. So let's invest in the people who are and kind of engage in, you know, partnership support, et cetera. Mm-hmm. What I have seen since has been really interesting. So I think a lot of CVC teams have really struggled because ultimately the big company is still the big company. And it still, you know, has the same metrics and incentives. So it's still risk adverse. It still wants immediate results. And that drives ultimately what they're willing to invest in. So, you know, talking with friends who, you know, their companies either have corporate venture capital arms or, you know, my friends are in them. What they see a lot is the amount the company is willing to invest is perfectly appropriate for very early stage startup, but at that stage, the startup is too risky. So once the startup gets to a point where their risk profile matches the company's willingness to accept risk, the buy-in price is way more than the company is willing to invest.
Yeah, definitely.
And so then you kind of have this awkward mismatch, which is, I think, the challenge that most CVC teams have run into.
Yeah, and I think it's different maybe in industries where, like industrial industries, where there's a operational return also.
I've
seen that too. Like, one of the topics we were going to talk about was OpenAI and Microsoft, and that's a good version or a good example of the CVC. Basically investing, or the company itself investing in this partnership where they own, I think, 49% on the outside, to both accelerate OpenAI's growth, but really build out the infrastructure of generative AI and how that's going to work for Microsoft in the future.
No, that whole OpenAI, Microsoft, I'll just say drama that has played out over the last couple of weeks. Like, I cannot wait for the Netflix version, be it miniseries or movie, because it's perfect for that, has been really interesting. Because like you said, you know, Microsoft, for a while, they had invested in building their own AI. And, you know, once OpenAI was kind of relatively far, you know, quotes, far along, you know, Microsoft also invested, like you said, they're 49% owner. And so it's just, it's been very interesting to watch OpenAI, which, you know, founded as a nonprofit. The board, you know, is a nonprofit board. Their role is very much to be stewards of generative AI and kind of help, you know, set the safety parameters, you know, the regulations, the guardrails, all of that, which is very different from a for-profit corporate board.
Yeah.
And, you know, you saw that play out when the OpenAI board fired Sam Altman. And then Microsoft was like, whoa, 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 you know, it's 49% owners, like, whoa, no. And then they went to, you know, they hired the two co-founders and were about to just hire everybody away from OpenAI. And then, you know, Sam Altman ultimately is invited and chooses to go back to OpenAI. And like, so it's this very interesting set of, I think, dynamics around, you know, nonprofit versus for-profit, stewards versus, you know, corporate board, the freedom to create, which OpenAI offers. Microsoft, even though they would, I'm willing to bet, I don't know, but I'm willing to bet, even though they would have probably let Altman and the team develop AI separately, there would still be eventually, you know, bridges in, metrics in, eventually there would be a Microsoftization that's, you know, staying totally separate prevents. So it's a very interesting, it's been very interesting to watch it play out and all of the different dynamics and questions and answers that kind of the whole drama revealed.
Yeah, that the company started as a nonprofit and now is a profit, I guess, profit seeking organization. It really, it's kind of like that cultural push pull, because you still have, like you said, the board members that were associated with that foundation of, we're developing AI for this nonprofit element. But then we became a for-profit that is in partnership with one of the biggest for-profit companies in the world. And it's, like you said, I think it will be a good drama someday, a TV drama, because it does have, I'm not going to say good versus evil, but it has like that paradigm between two sides that are almost opposed to each other in their foundations, really going at it. And then, I mean, the prophet went out, so he's back. And I think most of the board is gone, if I'm not mistaken.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. But it was, it was really interesting seeing that, how quick it operated. He was out. I'm sure he called Nadella, the CEO of Microsoft, and they were, I would say, probably pretty irate.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, and then having, what, 90% of the employees basically admit that the profit-seeking moment or motives of AI are what keeps it running and how that's needed to basically go forward with it. It was pretty exciting. So
it was very exciting. And it, I mean, I could see how it could be turned into a story of good versus evil. We're not there yet, but you know, especially this idea of, you know, the nonprofit board versus you know, Microsoft, which, you know, Microsoft has probably been in some sort of, you know, lawsuit, regulatory, you know, jailhouse, you know, kind of shame on you, court system, something for like the past 20 years.
Yeah.
And so kind of being at the dawn of this new radical technology, you know, ultimately it will get regulated. Everything eventually does. And this, recognition of like, well, we can regulate ourselves, which I think was probably the intent of forming the board, the nonprofit board in the first place. And if we don't regulate ourselves, the government will ultimately step in, and we don't want that. But then you have Microsoft, who owns 49% of a very, very, very big startup, being like, we want a return on our investment. So
yeah, totally.
The story is not done. I think we've gone through the opening chapter.
Yeah.
But it'll be very interesting to see how it plays out, because it does. It surfaces a lot of really important questions that go beyond just AI or just technology, that really go into kind of, you know, business, innovation, government, you know, and on from there.
Yeah, and I think you bring up a good point, because I'm sure Microsoft appreciates the fact that it's an external startup, because it removes some of that corporate governance risk on mm-hmm. developing it in-house. And
yep.
So it was a little weird scenario, but I'm sure everybody's happy with how it turned out, except for the board members that are gone.
I say except for the board members, but yeah, no, it definitely seems like folks are happy, and it will be interesting to see, because the questions around, you know, ethical use of AI, ethical development of AI, you know, all the risks. Yeah, those questions aren't resolved, and those, you know, we'll keep adding to those questions. So it'll be interesting to see how those evolve as well.
Yeah, there's some huge startups now that basically just clean trading data of all the garbage. So it's mm-hmm. it's kind of like, I think whether or not it's, you know, whatever the potential result is for this, I think the fear was that everybody would be out of a job immediately.
Yes.
And it's not, I don't know, like I kind of say it, it's that I don't think that there's necessarily a one ring to rule them all concept with AI. There's always going to be limitations in it, because it's trained on what's happened and what people tell it to do. But it's,
yeah,
I don't know, life is accelerating so quick in the technology space, and this is quite an interesting time to be alive. You know, the fourth industrial revolution is here, and
yeah,
just what I've seen over the last year, especially like taking still images and turning them into videos.
Yeah. And
it's just kind of mind blowing that you could do something like that in 15 minutes.
Yep. Yeah. It's amazing. It's funny. I'm old enough to remember when the internet kind of, you know, came out into being, into the world, out of the research and all that. And, you know, the great fear, it was the same fear of like, we will all lose our jobs. And, you know, especially like libraries and researchers will be completely like wiped off the face of the earth, because now all of the world's information is at your fingertips. And like, we still have libraries and we still have researchers, and they've adapted, right? And so it's like, no, AI isn't going to take our jobs. AI will change how we do our jobs and what we need to do. But it's not, you know, unless it becomes sentient and turns into, you know, whatever the machine was from the Terminator, it's not going to destroy us.
Yeah.
But it will change things, and we will absolutely kind of feel that loss of what we used to do. But what we lose, we will gain somewhere else.
Yeah. It's kind of like that, almost the Renaissance period, I feel,
all over again,
where, I mean, maybe, so in the last industrial revolution, it was really a, I guess, a labor-driven economy. And now it looks like it's more of a creator-driven economy, even if you're even if you're this analytical person, but the ability to communicate clearly to a computer, like you did with your formulas and your fingers, it's pretty cool. Like everything's getting disrupted in its own way. And it's pretty neat.
Yeah. No, I think back to, I think it was this summer, it was the Iowa World Fair that somebody entered a piece of art that they had used Midjourney to create, and it won. It won the blue ribbon in the art category. And that, you know, there was all this uproar because it's like, well, this isn't art. You used AI to create it. And the artist was like, look, I spent 80 hours, you know, tweaking this and evolving it and prompting, and like to get to this point. It's not like I just fed a prompt and AI spit this out and I was all done.
Yeah.
And, you know, to that point, you know, this guy is, I think he was, you know, a computer programmer. So he probably doesn't consider himself an artist in the sense that traditionally we would, but he created art. Mm-hmm. And then you get in the question of like, did he create, is computer generated art? Art in the sense of we still think of art as paintings and sculptures and things like that. So again, it raises really interesting questions. And I think to your point, like it allows all of us to be creators. Ultimately it's another tool. That's the thing. It's another tool that we can choose how we use. Mm-hmm. And there will always need to be a human element to that.
Yeah, I think that's well said. What do you what do you see as perhaps kind of the big development opportunities for AI into driving corporate innovation programs?
I think there's such huge opportunity. And it does freak me. Even when I think about it, I get a little freaked out. And I'm like, no, it's okay. This is all going to be good. You know, I think one of the biggest, most interesting areas I've seen, and I played around a bit with this, is using AI as a starting point for customer research. And, you know, so this is beyond kind of what we already think of as secondary research. Like, of course, you get like the industry reports and all of that stuff. But I'm talking the actual qualitative human, you know, human interaction research. And you know, one of the things, I spent about 9 years at Innosight, which was Clayton Christensen's innovation firm. And so one of the things I believe very deeply in is the jobs to be done approach of, you know, people don't buy things just to own them. Usually they buy them to solve a problem. And, you know, I've done so much jobs to be done research. It's incredibly, incredibly powerful because you get to the motivations. You get to those things that actually drive behavior. And the fact that I can sit down with ChatGPT and, you know, I did this with a client that kind of, all right, here are three sort of, you know, qualitative research reports, personas, things like that. Create jobs, create personas based on these, using jobs to be done. And it created four personas based on the research, called out the different jobs to be done, the problems to be solved at different points of the process, what the barriers were. You know, it was amazing. Was it right? It was 80%. Like, you know, it was 80%. Now, the 20% it was missing is the 20% that is honestly where the gold is, because that's the stuff where, you know, with a really good actual human-to-human interaction, you'll get the things, you know, the little nuggets, the little insights that give you the competitive advantage. But my gosh, if I can, you know, skip 80% of the work, or not skip it, but kind of, it used to be if you take an hour-long interview with somebody, 80% of that time was the fundamentals and 20% was getting the nuggets. If I can flip that and kind of just double check what the AI told me is kind of the basic common sense stuff and spend 80% of my time really digging into behavior and motivation, it's going to be like what gets created will be so much richer and more interesting. So, you know, again, it's like AI isn't going to eliminate the need for qualitative research, but it is going to change how we do it, which I think is really cool.
Yeah, it's definitely like it's always easier and better to have something to look at and to kind mm-hmm. of like have a starting point of a discussion and really
yep.
use that as a methodology to bring out people's views on certain situations. I just see like that rapid, like you said, that rapid acceleration of a starting point mm-hmm. as such an innovative thing. So
yeah,
you talked earlier about the publisher that you worked on
uh-huh.
previously. If you were meeting with a publisher today about AI, how would you perhaps maybe pitch to them in incorporating AI to either discover what might be a monetizable business or topic, or, you know, something around that?
Yeah, it's a great question because, you know, so the publisher that I worked with, it, yeah, how would I advise? I think, again, it goes back to like, first, we've got to acknowledge that AI is out there. So your readers who, you probably had a broad base of readers of people who, because of the publication was, people, one, who just like to have it sitting around because it connotes certain things about them, that they're very smart and worldly and fancy and all that stuff. So they'll keep buying because there's a, you know, in the jobs to be done parlance, there's social jobs to be done that the publication is meeting. And there are people who subscribe because they really value the perspective and the depth and the gravity with which, you know, the articles are written. But there's probably a huge cadre of people who skim through it. And it's, you know, it offers a perspective that they can't get when they, you know, scroll through Apple News or something on their phone. But those folks can now go to a Gen AI and type in their questions and get answers. And so you may be losing, you know, a huge group of people because Gen AI is a, at least now, kind of free, free source for what they need. So you have choices there. You can let them go and, you know, continue to cater to the people who are really like deeply invested in what you do. Or, you know, think about, okay, can you, you know, I know a lot of companies are kind of creating their own large language models. Can you create one that is specific to you
mm-hmm.
and your voice and your perspective, and maybe use that as a draw for people? You know, so it's really, again, going back to, okay, what are the different readers, or what are the different reasons that subscribers subscribe? Who is likely to look at Gen AI as a good enough solution? And can you create something that mirrors that or heads it off? And, you know, for this client, that would be deeply uncomfortable for them. That would be a true, like, identity challenging idea.
Yeah.
But they, as I say with all my clients, like, ignoring it isn't going to make it go away. So, like, let's wrestle with it and make a choice. Yeah. And we can always make a different choice, but like the ostrich approach doesn't only works for ostriches. And yeah. We are not an ostrich.
How does that coaching, executive coaching relationship work when they're perhaps pushing back on something like we're old school. This is the way that we've done it for 60 years. And, yep. and we understand that people are switching, but we want to be different by staying the same almost.
Yeah. Yes. It, it's very human. So person to person, one-on-one, because ultimately decision makers are making decisions. They make decisions with their heart and they justify them with their heads. So by the heart, you know, people are like, oh, I'm not emotional. It's like, okay, well, you're a human being, so you're emotional. So like, let's just one, acknowledge that. Two, like, we all have motivations and aspirations and fears and all, like, that is what makes us human. And if we can acknowledge those, then we can have a conversation about them.
Yeah.
Instead of, you know, what I see a lot of people do is they, you know, they try to use logic and data to justify the decisions. And that's where you hear the like, well, you know, we tried that before and it didn't work. This is actually something that publisher said. We tried that before and it didn't work. And I said, super helpful. You tried it before. When did you try it? What did you learn? And they said, we tried it in 1983. I said, and nothing has changed since 1983? And so it's like, oh, like, yeah. So yes, you did try it before. That is not in 1983, and therefore not a reason to not try it again.
Yeah.
But you have to get to kind of that level of like, what's really holding you back? What are you really afraid of? And how can we manage that?
Yeah. And so is that part like very, I guess, holistic specific coaching on certain managers? Because, you know, I could see that you might have the top person be against it, but everybody else on the team want it. And then the struggle that they have to, well, let's see, I think it was Olympus back in the day, or one of the Japanese camera makers that had a huge, I don't know if it was fraud or, but something was going on. And then they brought in an American accountant to be a part of their management team. And immediately he called it out. And there was a structure that you just kind of, even if you disagree with something, there's a hierarchy to it.
Yep.
And even if you, you know, just kind of like letting it go on, how difficult from an innovation aspect can that be, managing the relationships and kind of their existing almost like codependencies?
Yeah, it's super challenging, because there is a hierarchy in every company. I mean, companies are hierarchical. And so again, one is acknowledging it. Two is, you know, what I'm realizing more and more, and so I say more and more, is that innovation is not an idea problem, it's a leadership problem.
Mm.
Now, that's not the first thing I say to people, because, you know, the leader's like, we're not the problem. I'm like, oh yes, you are, but that's fine. We'll get to that. We'll get to that in a bit. So it's about kind of doing the work first. So like I said, player coach, being with the team and observing the interactions. Because, you know what, sometimes the leader isn't the problem, but the leader above that leader is. And so figuring out, okay, what are really the human dynamics at work? And, you know, one, then coaching the team lead, you know, the folks who are all in and believing it, be like, okay, this, you know, X just happened. Here are the reasons why that probably happened.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what can we do instead? And so then while helping the team kind of navigate those things that never really get discussed, also building a relationship with the leader so that I can have those one-on-one conversations and be like, look, you know, you're making an absolutely logical decision. You know, this is the trap most leaders fall into, is they have metrics where they have to deliver the quarter or the year. I get that. If they don't hit those metrics, their job is at risk, their bonus is at risk. So they absolutely make the logical decision. Except that's the logical decision for them based on metrics, incentives, logical decision for the company. But it is completely opposed to innovation, which is a long-term investment.
Yeah, definitely.
And so how do we reconcile that? Can we reconcile that? And if we can't, again, let's acknowledge it and let's figure out what we can do. But it is, it's a lot of conversation. It's a lot of, you know, being human with folks and, you know, being honest about what's really going on and what's getting in the way, because ultimately everything is, you know, it's a problem to be solved, but we can't solve it unless we know what the problem is.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, you know, to go back to Microsoft earlier, when they brought in Nadella, they really tried to transition that culture from big Microsoft into more of an agile startup environment. And that's, I would say that that's going pretty well, but especially due to their size, but it's a whole culture change. And a lot of people that had been there for a long time, like the way that they did things, have either retired or left just because they didn't want to maybe watch their baby die, so to speak. You know, the ecosystem that they've lived in for so long.
That is the challenge. Challenge is such an understatement, but the challenge of leadership, but you see that, like, it required Nadella to come in, CEO, and be like, we are changing this, and then stick with that change. You know, so many companies, it's like, you know, you hit an economic downturn, it's like, let's go back to the way things we always did because that worked. It's like, that worked in 1983. And, you know, so it's the CEO and it's sticking with it and being willing to let go of people who, you know, were instrumental in your success up to this date, but aren't a fit, aren't going to do their best work in the future. And that's all really hard leadership stuff, but that's ultimately what leadership is.
Yeah, definitely. So from like an innovation aspect, if you're really making a big shift, probably most, it's like you said, not just a big idea. You really have to look at the whole organization. And a lot of that would be centered around the type of people that you have too.
Yeah.
So I was just curious if you had any thoughts on how that holistic process looks. And maybe some of the challenges and also benefits going through.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one of my core beliefs is that anyone can innovate and anyone can be an innovator, but not everybody wants to be.
Yeah.
And that's okay because, you know, companies need innovators. They also need operators. They need people who are absolutely amazing at their jobs, at, you know, doing what the company does and finding ways to do it better, faster, cheaper. Like, you need those experts. You need those masters of the craft. And if people love playing that role, let them play it. Like, don't make them become innovators if that's not what they want to be. And so I see a lot of companies when they put innovation programs and they're like, everyone will participate. I'm like, no. No, it shouldn't be everybody. It should be if you want to participate, you can. Otherwise, like, go be awesome at what you do. I think there's, you know, there's also the people who want to be innovators where that's just not, you know, as we say, their zone of genius.
Yeah.
And I get it. Like, I'm a risk averse person by nature. I, you know, the ambiguity, the all of that stuff that goes with innovation. I think I went into innovation because I'm like, it needs to be organized and segmented and brought into order. I don't love the chaos, but that's okay. But there are some people who, you know, in the ambiguity and the chaos of innovation, as much as they want to be able to work with it, and like, it's just not who they are. And that can be a much harder journey to kind of realizing that about yourself. And those people are so really valuable to the organization. So help them kind of figure out where they're awesome at.
Yeah.
and then let them do that. And then the people who not only can innovate, but want to, figure out how to unleash them.
Yeah. How do you target specific people for, I guess, those roles as the innovator?
Yeah. So two things. One are, you know, do they volunteer? And, you know, with the volunteers, you get both kinds of people, so to speak. You get the people who are genuinely innovators and are comfortable with the ambiguity of innovation. And you get the people who want to be innovators. But as they go through the experience, they're like, I hate this. But the volunteers. I also look for the folks that I very lovingly describe as the misfit toys. So who are the people on the island of misfit toys? Because they're probably there because they're misfits. You know, they question the status quo. They suggest things that haven't been suggested for. They don't fit. And people recognize that they're really good at what they do, or they're really smart. They bring something really important. So you're not kicking them out of the organization, but you don't know what to do with them. I'm like, those are the innovators as well, because, you know, they are innovating. They're just innovating in an environment that doesn't want it or doesn't know how to respond to it. So, like, let's find the misfit toys and bring them in.
Yeah, I've definitely been there, you know, in that very structured environment with all these ideas. And, you know.
And you say, you know, in the conference room, you're like, why do we do it this way? And then it's just crickets. And you're like, I've just done something wrong, haven't I?
Well, because it's in the process system.
Yeah. Well, this is just how we've always done it. That's not actually an answer. So, yeah.
What's the best way to overcome that? If you're an innovator in a company, if you're one of the misfit toys, how do you best overcome that answer that this is the way that we've always done it? Even though when you see the commercial viability, the profitability viability in it, how do you overcome basically the hesitancy of certain people to really try something new?
Yeah, this is where it gets fun. So first off, lessons that I have learned the hard way, pick your battles. Not every battle needs to be fought. Some do.
Yeah.
Some don't, because they're annoying and stupid and we should change it, but I'm not willing to lose my job over it. But there are battles that are worth fighting. And for those things, when you choose to fight them, which is awesome if you choose, know that they will end in one of maybe two or three ways. One, you will be wildly successful. You will, against all odds, have created change, and you'll be rewarded for it. That happens never. Two, you will be wildly successful. You will drive change. Someone will say thank you. You may get a nice little token of gratitude. And then everyone, you know, will just go on doing what they do. So first, there will be no parade in your honor. There should be, but there won't be. But call me, I'll throw a little parade for you. Or you'll get fired.
Yeah.
And you know what? That is not the worst outcome. For me, the worst outcome is staying somewhere that doesn't appreciate the perspective you bring and isn't willing to consider doing something new, especially if you're someone who sees the opportunities for improvement, sees the opportunities for innovation, sees the signals in the market that this is required. If you are at a company that will not allow you to even try to respond to those signals, it's okay to get fired. Find a company that does appreciate that. So know those things up front. And then start kind of you know, the small experiments, the conversations, finding the people who agree with you and kind of building your little underground army, you know, running the experiments to get the proof points so that ultimately you can go to your boss or your boss's boss or whoever it is and present a really compelling data-based case for why change needs to happen.
Yeah.
And then change will happen or it won't, but you know what? You've got an answer you can do something with at that point.
Yeah, the coalition approach seems to work best.
Yes. Yeah. Innovation is a team sport, if only because, you know, it can get real lonely trying to change. And you need someone to be like, kind of just check you to be like, that's crazy, right? Like that doesn't, I'm not the crazy one. They're the crazy one, right? Okay. All right. Good. They're the crazy one. Got it.
Yeah, totally. 100% dig that. So I kind of wanted to just segment into your five core beliefs that drive Miles.
Yeah.
So if we could talk about that. Number one, innovation is something different that creates value.
Yep. That one, that is a core belief. The reason it is one, innovation is a buzzword. Like everybody uses the word and everybody has a different definition for it. So upfront, this is my definition. I see this literally all the time with my clients is you go around, you say, how do you define it? And you get eight people in the room, you're going to get nine definitions. And that right there kind of starts the problem of innovation in an organization is you have somebody thinking, oh, we're going to create a radically new product. Somebody else thinks innovation is optimizing things. And so when they say we need to innovate, everyone has different expectations.
Yeah.
So innovation is something new. And that something can be almost anything. It can be a product. It can be a process. It could be a revenue. It could anything. It doesn't have to be a product. New can mean new to the world. It can mean new to your industry, new to your company, new to your business. So it doesn't have to be new to the world, but it has to be new in some aspect. And then the last part of creating value is the critical component because something new is an invention. And, you know, the invention may create value. So then it becomes an innovation as well. And sometimes it's just an invention and no one knows what to do with it. But like now we know it's possible and that's great and that's fine. And we need invention. Innovation creates value. And again, value can be a lot of different things. It can be monetary, revenue, cost savings, profit. But there can also be qualitative aspects to that. You know, are you improving customer satisfaction or are you improving employee satisfaction, loyalty? You know, what are some of those qualitative aspects of value as well that an innovation can drive? But an innovation that doesn't create value is an invention at best.
Yeah, I think that's it. I like the way that you say it because it provides a framework for it that's actionable and measurable.
Yep. Yeah. I get a lot of pushback on the measurement. And I understand it feels like things are going to be less fun if you have to worry about measuring things, but you know, that what gets measured gets managed. And, you know, one of the things around companies and innovation is everybody has scarce resources. Nobody has unlimited resources. And so ultimately resources get allocated to things that get returns. And if you can't explain the returns that your innovation are going to provide the value, you're not going to get the resources.
Yeah. And I think that kind of leads into number two with the commitment aspect. So your number two core belief is innovation requires curiosity, courage, and commitment. And I, you know, to maintain that commitment over time, I think that it really benefits to have those measurable outcomes based on a proper ideal. So people can remember why they're doing it, even when they forget.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, when panic or concern or whatever inevitably sets in because something is going on in the world outside of our control, be it a pandemic, be it a recession, be it a war, whatever it is, you know, if we keep withdrawing or if we keep stopping the things that feel risky, we're never gonna make the change that we need to make, because change takes a lot longer than we think. And so if you don't stick with it, you're constantly resetting the clock.
Yeah, definitely. How do you foster curiosity in a company as an outside consultant?
Questions. Get people comfortable asking questions. And some people just naturally are very comfortable with it. They instinctively do it. Other folks, for a lot of good reasons, have been trained to always appear certain. And so one of the things I do when we're working on a project is say, okay, you know, we're going to start experimenting. We're going to list all of our assumptions. And immediately people freak out. We're not assuming anything. Okay, yeah, you are, but fine. So then hypotheses, what are our hypotheses? And so folks write them down. And then one of the things that we do to help prioritize is say, okay, well, you know, how confident are you that this hypothesis is true? And what's the impact if it's wrong? And if you just say that, you know, high, medium, low confidence, where are you at? Everything is high confidence. High confidence, we're right. So, okay. So for something to be high confidence, you have to bet your annual salary that it's true.
Yeah.
Suddenly everything becomes medium confidence. Huh. And then I'll be like, okay, medium confidence is you are taking all of us out to a Michelin starred restaurant and we're doing like the full multi-course wine, like all the things, Michelin star, and you're paying for it. Then not everything becomes low confidence, but a lot of things become low confidence. And so it just kind of says like, it's okay that you don't know the answer. Like these are questions and we can go test and solve the questions. And let's tackle the biggest, most important, most impactful, least confident hypotheses first. And so it's step by step kind of revealing that they don't know as much as they think they know, and then giving them a framework and a reason for why it's okay they don't know and a path forward.
Yeah, and I think that would develop a lot of courage too. People people feel more courageous when they're operating in that repeated environment where they're constantly being curious.
Yeah. And you give them a framework and, give them a 2x2 or a 3x3 and like, okay, well, the worksheet says to do it. Keep using the tool until you don't need it anymore. And this just becomes a way you think. And inevitably that does happen, but like any habit, it takes conscious practice.
Yeah, definitely. So your third core belief, any organization can innovate and any person can be an innovator.
Yep. Yeah. As I said, anyone can do it. Not everybody will, not everybody wants to, but everyone's capable of it. And I think it's important, you know, one, to recognize the difference between being capable of something and wanting to do something. I think it's also important to, you know, going back to curiosity and, you know, creativity is a lot of times somebody will get bucketed as like, oh, you're an innovator. So you go off and you do the crazy things. And then everybody who's not an innovator, you just stay here and do the same thing. And then when all the not innovate, somebody in the not innovators questions things, it's like, oh, how dare you? And so, you know, we were all kids, right? And kids were creative and curious. And we all still have that part of ourselves. And so allow that to come out in people. You know, you don't have to have an innovation title to engage in a lot of the behaviors that drive innovation. And, you know, so let people engage in that questioning and that creativity and, you know, in play and mess. And, you know, you don't have to bucket people and then confine them to those buckets.
Yeah, that's great. So number four, people, even your customers and your boss, decide with their hearts and justify with their heads. So we talked a little bit about that and earlier, and I just curious if you had any more thoughts on it.
Yeah, I think just another thought to add in is a lot of times companies, teams, you know, they'll focus on the customer, which is awesome. Like, yes, you have to understand your customer. And then, you know, you go present to your boss. And as you alluded to, like, somebody's gonna be like, why are we doing that? No, that's different. And so you have customers within your organization that you need to understand just as well as the customers outside of your organization. And I think a lot of people forget that. And, you know, it's first, whatever you're working on has to get approved internally before you can even give the market a chance to say whether it's successful or not. And so if you're not understanding those internal customers and those internal decision makers, your idea is never going to get out the door. Mm-hmm. And so recognize that just because we're all in a business setting doing business things, it doesn't mean that, you know, everything is perfectly logical because we're human.
Yeah, definitely. 100%. And your fifth core belief, ideas are a dime a dozen, decisions are priceless. Yes. Action is perfection. This is my favorite of the five personally, because it's true. Like it seems like pretty much everything has been thought before. And you mentioned that example of the company that tried that thing back in 1983 earlier.
Yeah.
And it's just interesting. Decisions and action and then testing, it's all mm-hmm. it's all great stuff.
Yeah. I mean, you think of a brainstorming session, like you get hundreds of ideas of a brainstorming session. Awesome. If you don't do anything with them, like you just spend an hour coming up with ideas, like, okay. You know, and so I see a lot of time and effort and energy and money spent by companies to come up with ideas and then a real reticence to make decisions. Cause like, oh, well, what if we pick the wrong idea? Well, if you don't pick any idea, you're going to get nowhere. So like, just pick one. And at the very least, you'll be able to say, that was a bad idea. Let's not do it again and go to the next one. Mm-hmm. So you've got to make a decision to move things forward. But if you don't act on it, if you don't, like you're saying, run the experiments, okay, you just have an idea that you decided to work on. Like, value is not going to get created if you don't do something.
Yeah, 100%. And how often do you see that in corporate innovation programs, that they're really good at generating ideas, but then it just, maybe the team isn't enabled, or they don't have the right people, or they didn't allocate enough resources. So the decisions never happen, and therefore, you know, really actions never go anywhere.
Yeah, far more than I like to admit. And this is where you see that innovation isn't an idea problem, it's a leadership problem. Mm-hmm. Because the team will come up with tons of ideas. They'll do the work they can to narrow it down. But ultimately, you know, they have something. They have a nugget of a business idea, product, whatever it is, and they need more investment. And so you go to the people who can give you the investment, and inevitably, 99.9% of the time, you hear like, well, I need more data. Well, things that have never been done before don't have data to support them. So the only way to get data is to do something. But to do something, we need resources. But you're saying, in order to get resources, I need to give you data. We are now in a chicken and egg situation. And typically, the leader does the very logical thing, which is, I have finite resources. A dollar I give to you with no promise of ROI is a dollar I can't give to the current business where I have a defined ROI and a defined time period, mm-hmm. and innovation loses out. And this is the struggle of corporate innovation, and why it's so like, it's very gratifying to focus on ideas, because then you're never at risk.
Yeah.
When you make a decision, and then when you put resources behind it so that action can be taken, now you're at risk. And so, you know, you get conversations like I had several years ago with a client where they're like, we need a business that launches in 2 years that will be 250 million revenue in 4 years. And I was sitting with the innovation team when they said that, and the innovation team was two people. And I was just like, okay, let me just stop you there. Because if I could do that, I would be doing that. I would not be sitting here at this table. I would be creating the $250 million in 4 years business. And so it is, it's about kind of that education of innovation takes time, it takes resources, and it takes commitment, it takes courage. And if that's not where you're at, that's okay. But like, let's call it.
Yeah. Yeah. What popped in my head was thinking about that corporate venture capital structure before. You could almost think about having an internal corporate venture capital too, where it's just a separate fund set aside to go out and play and see what happens. And you use the resources and structure of the business where you can to build up those fundamentals. So if
I love that.
Yeah. It's like pharmaceutical company, for instance, they have that really structured test structure. But if they're also a manufacturer, it's, you know, it's just everything's got a cost center. So sometimes it's hard to do something. But what if you have basically like a entrepreneur with a really good idea, what sort of advice would you give them to frame their innovation and help them scale, you know, kind of within this little more structured environment, I guess?
So first off, understand your customers, the internal and the external ones. Figure out what problems you're solving. Because your idea is inevitably solving a problem, you know, a more tangible problem, something like that. But also kind of know the intangible problems that will come up. The, you know, how are people incentivized? How are people measured? You know, what's important? What's a big priority versus a small priority? Like, really understand the landscape. And then if you choose to fight the battle, if you choose to pursue the idea, like we talked about, build the coalition and run experiments, and be willing to break the rules. Like, the rules are there to keep everyone safe and everything progressing as it is. And if you follow those rules, you will end up in the same place that you already are. So figure out how to smartly and safely break the rules. And this very specific tip that a friend of mine taught me, it's a magic phrase that, because you will hear no all the time, ask people what they need to see to say yes.
Yeah, that's great advice.
Because it changes the conversation. You're enrolling them as a partner, as a problem solver, and you're getting really valuable information. Because if they say, like, there's literally nothing on heaven and earth you could show me that would get me to say yes, like, that's really important to know.
Yeah.
But if there is something that could get them to say yes, go get it.
Yeah, that's a great, great sales. You know, if you think about sales, like, that could save you so much time.
Yeah. Yep.
And there's been so many cases where people have gone after ideas that just aren't relevant. I mean, people are trying to be nice, or I don't know.
Yes. People will try to be nice. They will. And one of the things that I coach my clients, but also I teach. So I coach my students on when they're presenting prototypes, is say the least amount possible, because the more you talk, the more you describe, the more people are going to realize how invested you are. And so the nicer they're going to be, which means the less honest. And
great advice.
if you have something that people are like, oh, they spend so much time and energy and they really like, nobody's going to call the baby ugly, but the baby is ugly. Huh. So yeah, you need people to be honest with you.
Yeah,
and yeah. You know, you may not like what they say, but it's honest.
Yeah. Kind of like a last question here on industries. What are the industries right now that you're most excited about? I guess current or future innovation, how they're being affected or disrupted.
Yeah. So I think as we talked about, anything that is, you know, Gen AI touches on. So a lot of that is professional services.
Yeah.
So very interesting to see how that plays out. I think there is clean tech, I think is very interesting because there's a lot happening in Europe in terms of legislation and laws around what companies have to do, have to prove. There's mm-hmm. also a lot of backlash now around like, hey, you know, things that we thought were clean energy, you know, when you actually think about the total lifetime cost, you know, actually aren't as good for the environment as we thought. So I think there's a very interesting tension that is coming to a head in clean tech. I think mm-hmm. that will be very interesting to watch. I think also kind of related to that, and this is probably because of a client I'm working with now, but the question around food and farming and agriculture, you know, as we see the effects of climate change, as we see, you know, climate shifting. I saw an article a couple of weeks ago that like Sweden is likely going to become the next major wine producing region.
Wow.
Sweden.
That's crazy.
Like, so there's going to be a lot of stuff happening, not in the next 2 years, but certainly maybe in the next 5 to 10, that's going to require some rethinking. And that just creates lots of opportunity for innovation and disruption and all those fun things.
Yeah, I'm all with you. Well, this has been a fantastic conversation. I really appreciate you joining me and talking about.
I had a great time. This was fun.
So, hope everybody enjoyed the conversation, and we'll be back with more in the future.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
And that wraps up another episode here at New Next, where the future isn't just something we predict. It's something we're creating together. But the conversation doesn't end here. We want to hear your thoughts, your ideas, and your visions for what comes next. Head over to MatthewADJensen.com to share your feedback on today's episode. Your insights not only fuel our discussion, but also help shape future episodes of the New Next. And while you're there, take a moment to explore how Matthew Jensen can help guide you through the intricate world of strategy and digital transformation. Whether you're looking to innovate, transform, or just stay ahead of the curve, let us help turn your challenges into opportunities. Before you move on to your next podcast or dive back into your day, take a moment to rate us. Your ratings help us reach more like-minded innovators and thinkers, expanding our community of future makers. Whether you're a tech enthusiast, a forward thinker, or just curious about the world's next chapter, thank you for joining us on this journey. Remember, the future isn't just something to be predicted. It's something we are actively shaping with every discussion, every idea, and every action. Until next time, keep pushing the boundaries of what's possible. Let's explore the future together. This is the New Next. Program.